Good afternoon, and welcome back from the two-week break between the fact that it's the first week in January and the fact that the weather is terrible. I can see that not everybody made it back from the break, or made it back at 1:30 from the break. We'll see as time goes by. We are in Ezra chapter 2. We are getting towards the end of the parak, towards the end of the chapter. I do expect us to wrap the chapter this week and move on to chapter 3, leaving name lists in the, you know, in the rear view mirror for now, but hopefully a little bit wiser about how the name lists work and what their multiple purposes are. Right. That's been the theme of the parak, the theme of the chapter. We started out with the introduction to Zerubbabel as the political leader and focal point for the transition for the Jewish people. We talked a little bit about Zerubbabel versus Sheshbazzar. And then we moved right into the census. And we asked the question of why we have such detail here. And we gave several reasons, going all the way back to the original reason that this was the norm for poetry way back when. At some point, listing people's names actually was fascinating to do. To the idea that it emphasizes the importance of the people, the human beings involved, the fact that we take the time to name all of them and lay them out, as opposed to when we deal with the construction of the temple, where we do not get a great deal of detail. We talked about it, you know, sort of two opposing ideas. Either that listing everybody helps to feel like there's a large group, or just the opposite, the fact that you can list everybody makes it seem like a small group. And then we added two more ideas as we went along. We noted that the people who are listed here in chapter 2 are the founders of the society. They are the ones who end up offering various offerings, not just themselves, but their descendants in the temple. They're the founders of the new institutions of the land, and that may warrant their being mentioned. And then we saw another reason when we got to the end of the list, and we saw the Netinim, these people who had joined into the Jewish people to become servants, right? Whether they were the Givonim or other groups. But these are people who are not of good standing and not of good status within the Jewish people in terms of marriage. And that led to the suggestion, which the Talmud itself makes, that the purpose of the list may be to tell us who can marry whom. And not just us, the readers now, but the people of the time need to document who is able to marry whom. So that's a fifth reason for having this list. So we talked about the Netinim, we talked about Avdei Shlomo, the servants of King Solomon, and that brings us to chapter 2, sentence 59. If you're using the Art Scroll Stone Tanakh, it's page 1817, 1817. That's what we are up to. I will note that this class is actually dedicated by Dov and Bani Bigun in memory of Yitzchak Isaac Barav Moshe. So that's the dedication for the learning today. Okay, so here we're going to see more groups with questionable lineage to round out our list. Let's take a look. Sentence 59. Ve'ele ha'olim mitel melach tel charsha kruv adan imer. Okay, these are the people who ascended from the following places. These are Babylonian places. So people from tel melach, people from tel charsha, people from kruv adan imer. I believe kruv adan imer is one place name, not multiple place names. I want to see how the art scroll does it. No, they do actually, they list them all as separate. They list it as Kruv, one place, Adan, another place, and Imer, yet another place. There too? Where is that? Got it. Okay. Interesting. So they all are viewing it as different cities. Okay. V'lo yachlu lahagid beis avosam v'zaram im Yisrael heim. And they couldn't tell you what their ancestry was. They couldn't even tell you whether they were Jewish. These are people within the group who obviously claim some kind of association with the Jewish people, that they wouldn't be there, I think most likely what we're suggesting is that these are people who claim to have some Jewish parentage, but it's not clear whether they have enough Jewish parentage or the right Jewish parentage such that they will be Jewish. Right? Go back to issues of matrilineal descent. The question is, are these people halachically Jewish? And they couldn't tell you. And so we get B'nai Delaya, B'nai Tovia, B'nai Nekoda. Those are the three families who are involved, which inclines me to believe that there were three city names. That's why I was biased towards reading it as three cities instead of five, because there are three families. But these three families, Sheish Meos Chamishim Ushnayim, the 652. That's our group, and clearly, you know, they are mentioned and identified in this way as a means of making sure that nobody is going to marry among them. So this way we all know these people have now been singled out, they've been named as people who cannot say for sure that they're Jewish. Yeah?
Because this is also a time historically when all the captive nations were given their liberty. Babylon, not just the Jews.
Whether it's all, we don't know. What we do know is that there was this practice, which we saw documented on the Cyrus Cylinder, of allowing certain people to go back to their homes and build their temples and so on. We don't know whether it's all, but we know that at least it occurred for the Jews and it occurred for the Babylonians who have been conquered by the Persians. That's who we know. Yeah. Why you're asking that? Because you're suggesting that someone within this group may have been from other... Could be. It's possible. But I think the fact that they're going through what turns out to be a terrible and very difficult experience like this suggests they must have some reason for being with us. It's not just, hey, they're going somewhere interesting, let's go along for the ride. These are people who claim to have Jewish heritage, they just can't prove it. They can't provide a documentation of their lineage.
Ibn Ezra says, from my reading, that he thought they were foundlings.
Yeah. The foundling point that he's getting into is the Shtuki and Asufi discussion, which I mentioned, I think, last time. When last time is 3 weeks ago, it's hard. But we'll see that more clearly represented, not here, but in the seventh chapter of Nehemiah. We'll see how it's going to be read into the words on the list there, and that's where we'll get the Shtuki and the Asufi. Yeah.
I'm sorry, I came late, but is there an issue that some of these may have been
Mamzerim
and that's why they couldn't identify
their
lineage?
So we're going to get into Mamzerim in Nehemiah chapter 7 as well.
Right.
It's not mentioned clearly in this list. Is it possible that they would have concealed it? Could be. It's entirely possible. But we'll get a better reference to it in Nehemiah 7. It'll be 761 for those who don't want to wait until they get to Nehemiah chapter 7, so you can take a look at it in advance. But these aren't the only people with problematic lineage. We also have Kohanim, who have issues with proving their lineage. Now, the goal of lineage for someone we know is a Kohen, right? So, there's no question they're Jewish, and we know what tribe they're from. But the goal of lineage is to prove that they're not what we call a halal. Remember that a Kohen, not kosher for Islam, different word. There are rules for who a Kohen is allowed to marry. Right, the most prominent being that a Kohen is not allowed to marry a divorcee. So, in the event that a Kohen marries somebody he's not allowed to marry, he himself, the male, is able to serve in the temple once that marriage ends. However, his child remains a halal forever, with no way for anybody to know who he is and who he isn't, so to speak. You can't look at a Kohen and know that he's a halal at all, and you're going to say, well, his last name is Kohn. I guess that means that he's a Kohen. So they have to document that in their lineage you won't find any halalim, that you won't find that they are either the children of such a marriage or descendants of such a marriage. So, umibnei ha-kohanim, Pasuk Samach Aleph, sentence 61, again, we're on page 1817 in the Stone Tanakh, Ubnei HaKohanim, among these Kohanim who have problematic lineage, are Bnei Chavaya, Bnei Hakotz, Bnei Barzilai, Asher Lakach Mibnos Barzilai Giladi Isha VaYikarei Al Shemam. So among the Kohanim you have the sons of Chavaya, the sons of Hakotz. Hakotz is an interesting one, because Hakotz is actually going to be a prominent name later on. either because they get rehabilitated at some point, like, oh, now we found our lineage, or because there are different subsets of the Hakotz family, and one subset is the one here that isn't able to identify their lineage, and the prominent one that we'll get to later is going to be one that is able to prove that they are okay. So, you know, there are different ways to explain why Hakotz later are going to be on the good list, and right now Hakotz is on the bad list. And then you have the ones who are descended from Barzillai HaGiladi. Who was Barzillai HaGiladi? David, close. King David's court, a supporter and ally of David HaMelech. David wants him to move to Yerushalayim. He becomes important in Halacha because David wants him to move to Yerushalayim to come under his shelter there. And Barzillai says, I'm already an old man. I think he's 80 years old at that point. And he says, I am old and I'd rather just be at home. You know, I'm going to forego the protection you're going to give me. This becomes a halachic source in discussions about moving somebody into a home versus leaving them in their home. Because Barzillai's statement is, you know what, it's better for me to stay home rather than go to a place where I'm going to have the protection of the king. So it becomes an interesting source in that discussion. But the point is, it's a prominent name. And therefore it makes a lot of sense that you will have people who will want to be known that way. In other words, they marry the daughters of Barzillai HaGiladi, and normally names in biblical texts are going to be patriarchal. They're going to follow the male. But in this case, they say, you know what, we're going to take the name, we're going to adopt the name of Barzillai, because he's a prominent person. So Vayikarei al Shemam, this family went by the name of the daughters of Barzillai.
Because the kids are Kohanim. It makes sense.
Right, because Barzillai is not necessarily... I don't know who Barzillai's original... I know his original Shevet. It could... I can't prove that. But yes, even if Barzillai is not a Kohen, and being from Gilad suggests he wouldn't be, but not necessarily. You could have Kohenim who were there. Gilad, remember, is east of the Yarden. Right? The central area east of the Yarden is Gilad.
But the daughters... are not
Kohanim. Right.
It passed on. It only comes from the
father. Right, and that was Gita's point, was that you, even if Barzillai is not, we're still fine.
Yeah.
Correct. However, their problem is the next sentence. Ela bikshuk savam hamisyachsim velo nimtza'u. They went looking for their documents of lineage, but they were nowhere to be found. Vayigo alu min hakihuna. They were removed from the kihuna. Don't be tricked by the positive meaning of gimel aleph lamed, which often means to redeem. That is not what this means. This is the opposite. This is a negative. If you think of the criticism of, I think it's Yeshaya, of the Jewish people for bringing lechem and migo'al to Hashem. Lechem migo'al is rejected bread, rejected food to God for bringing an inappropriate carbon. The other example would be from Daniel. Right, those who were here when we learned Daniel together, sentence 62. We have some people here who learned Daniel with us. So when we learned it then, the first parak, Daniel says that he doesn't want to eat the bread from the king's table because he does not want to be migo'al, and what he's saying is he doesn't want to be disqualified. There's something wrong with eating from that. There's a lot of debate as to how to read that word in Daniel. The Barbanel has his own take. But the point that I'm trying to make is, Vayigo alum and hakihuna does not mean they were redeemed from being Kohanim, rescued from the kihuna. It means, like the art scroll renders it here, disqualified. They lose their standing. I think it's with an ayin. Yeah, there is this term of gimel ayin lamed, right, to be revolted by something. And, to exude. So, Vayomer Hatirshasa Lahem. So here we get a very important word, Hatirshasa. Right now we're just going to translate it as Hatirshasa, because that's the word, I can't do it. That's the word that the art scroll uses. We're going to come back to explain it in a moment, but I want to just do the content of the pasuk first. So, Hatirshasa says to them, asher lo yochlu mikodesh hakadashim, that they shall not eat from the holy of holies, meaning the most sacred korbanot, ad amod kohen leurim uletumim, until there is a kohen with the urim vetumim, which means the breastplate of the Kohen Gadol, right? The Urim Betumim is the Kehuna Gedola, you have the high priest. That's actually a problem. What's the idea of having a high priest with an Urim Betumim with a breastplate?
To interpret the words of Hashem.
Yeah, it was associated with prophecy. In other words, once we have a Kohen Gadol who can wear the Urim Betumim, then he is going to be able to determine who they are via special divine knowledge. The problem that we have with this is that the Gemara in Yumat, Daf Chaf Aleph, says that we don't have Urim Betumim in the second Beis HaMikdash, the second temple. We never had it. So how do I explain this line? So take a look on your sheet where I brought you three different approaches. Pick them. Source number one, the Malvim says, understood, but they didn't know that at the time. Right? They didn't know they weren't going to have an Urim Betumim. That's the simplest answer. Right? Malvim says, Shim hayu zochim az, had they merited it, haysa shechina shava eleim b'yisheni v'yalem Urim Betumim. The Shechina, God, would have come back to them, been manifest among them, and they would have had this breastplate with the stones on it, the Urim Betumim. When they came back to Israel, they thought that was going to happen. Right? That's the simplest and easiest explanation. However, the Gemara in Sota, which Rashi brings here on this pasuk, says, Ka'adam shomer lachaveiro ad sheyich yumesim v'yavo Mashiach ben David. It means until Mashiach comes, then you may be kohanim. Which, you know, you could read one way or another. Rashi tends to read it kind of cynically, like, yeah, sure, eventually you'll be back. The Mesudat David reads it, though, as non-cynically, as, no, once Mashiach comes, then you'll be okay. Whenever that's going to be, we don't know when. Ibn Ezra's take in number three is Aramot Kohen Haro'ilu Urim Bulatumim. Ibn Ezra says it's not about prophecy at all. It's not we're waiting for prophecy so that you can now come back in because God is going to reveal you to be kosher Kohanim. Rather, what it means is until there is a Kohen Gadol who would be suitable to wear the Urim Betumim. If there were Urim Betumim, he would wear it. In other words, the emphasis is not you will be in once we have prophetic revelation. It's you will be in once we have a Kohen Gadol who can issue a ruling. That's what they're actually waiting for. So who is this Hatir Shasa who tells them what to do? What are we talking about? So that even though the art scroll translates it as Hatir Shasa, as though it's a name, and the H-A, the He in the Hebrew, is part of the name, the general consensus is that that's not the way to read it. But rather, Ha is the definite object. The Tir Shasa is the general consensus for how this is supposed to be read. What does it mean? So the Dat Mikra says Tirshata means his honor, and even Ezra does the same thing, and they suggest it's Zerubbabel. In other words, this is Zerubbabel's title; it's his position. And the Tirshata said to them, "It's a little bit odd because Zerubbabel has been named here, so you could have said Zerubbabel told them." But nonetheless, the assumption is it means the authority. Encyclopedia Mikra'it tries to give all sorts of etymologies to explain the origin of the word Tirshata, but that's but what it means is the official made this statement. And we're going to see this word again. We're not done with this word. It's going to show up elsewhere within our reading. There's a unique take on it. Rashi quotes the Talmud Yerushalmi with a remarkable take, and I brought it for you in number four. Velama nikra shmo Hatir Shata. Why is he called Hatir Shata? Sheitiru lo lishtot biyayin. For they permitted him to drink the wine. What in the world is he talking about? So for this you need to know who Nehemiah was. Nehemiah, in the second of our two books, or the second half of our book, if you wish, is going to bear the title Hatir Shata. We're going to see it in Nehemiah chapter 8. What was his role in the king's court?
Only drinks wine first to make sure that it's not poisoned.
Yep, he is the cupbearer for the king, which involves drinking the wine. And the problem is, what is he doing drinking the wine? Don't we have a decree against the wine that they would have been using in the royal court? It's not kosher. And they permitted Nehemiah to drink the wine in the hope that he would be able to have an influence on the future of the Jewish people, these Persian exiles who are now trying to come back. In other words, this is, and it fits in the Talmudic discussion, part of an overall trend of leniency on various rabbinic rules for the sake of getting close to the government. Another example of it is there's a prohibition against getting a haircut called kumi. It seems to be some kind of a haircut in which all the hair was pulled back in some kind of a ponytail. And it was very popular among the aristocracy, and it was considered to be a non-Jewish hairstyle. It was chukot akum, a style of the non-Jews. However, they permitted it for certain people, certain families, so that they could get close to the government. It was so that this was a justifiable purpose. So to hear, they permitted for Nehemiah. So how do you see that in the word Hatir Shata?
Rishut.
Not Rishut. Nope. Good. Shana gets it. Heter Shata. Heter is permission, like mutar. Shata, to drink. So Hatir Shata is Heter Shata, permission to drink. I don't think that's necessarily meant as a literal read on the name. I think it's an added association with the name in terms of what the name will mean for us. In other words, I think Hatir Shata was a Persian title. However, Jews looked at that and saw this other message, this other meaning in the name. Okay, so it is clearly, whatever you take on it, whether you read it as the Tirshata or whether you read it as Hatirshata, it is clear that it's a reference to a person in authority. It will ultimately be the title used for Nehemiah. At this stage, we think Nehemiah is not there yet, because we haven't gotten to it in his book. We're going to come back to that actually in a bit and maybe challenge that. But right now we assume Nehemiah is not present. And if Nehemiah is not present, who's the authority now? Zerubbabel would be the last named authority. So he's the one who's going to... he's the one who says to them, you have to wait until we have either an Urim Vetumim or a Kohen who is suited to wear the Urim Vetumim. And at that point, he can decide your ability to eat from the Kodesh HaKadoshim, to eat from the Karbonot, to eat from the offerings. You're not able to eat the offerings yet, so you're going to have to wait. Now, mind you, what they can't eat is the Holy of Holies. Meaning carbonate, meaning offerings. There are other tithes that they are able, there are other ways they're able to participate in the kihuna, just not in terms of, in this way. Okay. That brings us to the total. Any questions on that, on the Kohanim Hatir Shata before we... Yeah, Lori.
What happened to the Urim?
So that's a very good question. We are told that the general kelim, the general vessels, like we talked about in the opening weeks, end up in Babylon. However, we aren't told about any withholding of particular ones to stay there, which leads to the question of Sanu, where is it? There is a Gemara in Yuma which talks about Yirmiyahu, in the days of King Yoshiyahu, hiding some of the vessels beneath the floor of the temple. So most prominently the Aron would be hidden there. In other words, at that point he has already received messages from God saying it's all over, this is going to be destroyed, and therefore he wants to safeguard the vessels. And the Gemara tells the story of somebody during the Second Temple period who notices an element on the floor, some stone that's out of place, and he dies before he can tell anybody exactly where it was that he found what was underneath, which is to say the Aron and so on. So we have conflicting accounts of what it was. Did they go into Babel, or were they hidden intentionally by the Jews in the time of the First Temple? What we do know is the Second Temple doesn't feature it at all. Meaning, when you read Shmuel and Malachim, you see accounts of kings and officials seeking counsel from God. And it's generally understood, sometimes more explicitly, sometimes less so, that it means they go to the Kohen Gadol and they inquire through this special prophetic means, you know, what exactly God wants them to do. We don't find anything like that in Haggai and Zechariah and Malachi in the first days, and we don't know anything about it from the period of the Hashmonaim, right? And other than that, we don't have a whole lot of literature to work with. But it's, you know, the fact that it's missing is testified to by its absence, effectively. The fact that it's not in the narrative at all, where it was in the narrative in the first Beis HaMikdash. There are also nuances in the text that are drawn upon. The Gemara in Yuma Chaf Aleph draws on in Haggai, when Hashem says, if you build this, Ikavda, I will be honored by it, but it's missing the letter Hey. So the Gemara says that hints at the five things that are missing in the second temple. There are hints in various
there
places.
Two, one or the other.
So it's the Aron, the Urim V'Tumim. It is, I'm trying to remember. No, the menorah is there. The menorah is there. It features prominently in some holiday. I'm trying to remember if the Aron and the Kaporis count as two different things, such that the Kruvim are separate. If you look at Yuma Chaf Aleph Amud Aleph, you'll find it there. But I think the Kruvim may count separately.
The Luchos can't be there either.
Right. The question is how many of those. Right. The question is how many of these things get counted separately in order to reach five? Right. Yeah. How far can we play this out? No, I think one is the Mun. The jar of the man that they had saved from Aaron that was supposed to be there, the Mishmeres. I think the man is one of those that's gone. But it's a straight Gemara. You just have to read it. Okay. So we get to the totals. Now that we've listed everybody, now we get to the totals, which, by the way, will not add up. Pasuk Samach Dalet, sentence 64. Kol HaKahal Ke'echad, the entire community has one, Arba Ribo. 40,000, Alpayim, 2,000, Shlosh Meos, 300, Shishim, 60. In other words, 42,360. That's what you got. Milavad Avdehem Ve'am Hosehem, Ela, aside from their male and female servants, Shivas Alafim Shlosh Meos, Shloshim V'Shivah, 7,337. Not a bad ratio. Vilahem, Mishorim, Umishoros, Masayim. Oh, and by the way, they also had male and female singers. 200 male and female singers. We're going to come back to all of this. So hold your questions about what the singers are doing there. Suseihem, horses. Shrameo Shloshim Vishisha, 736. Pirdehem, and of course we have to have mules. Masayim Arboim Vachamisha, 245. Gemalehem, camels, Arbameo Shloshim V'chamisha, 435, Chamorim, and donkeys, Sheshes Alavim Shvameos V'esrim, 6,720. I didn't actually break this out to see the ratio of different animals and which ones were more and which ones were less, but we did note a while back that this is one of the elements that testifies to the fact that the list is recorded contemporarily. The list is recorded at the time when they actually make the return and not retrofitted. Because somebody counting later on would have had all sorts of animals that you use in running a farm, agricultural animals. Right? If you look at what they have here, these are pack animals. Animals that are suitable for long trips. Once you're settled in Israel, you don't have camels. That's not what you have. What you do have are cows, bulls, ox, you know, like that's what should be here and isn't here at all, testifying to the original character of the list itself. But our first problem that we have to look at is the number issue. Because when you count out our numbers, if you were to add up all the different families that we've seen, you won't end up with 42,360. What you will end up with, according to the Midrash and Seder Olam, is 30,360. You're about 12,000 short. So, where did they go? So take a look at number 5. This Medrash in Seder Olam, which is quoted by Rashi. Ubifrat einon ela shloshim elef ushlosh meyos v'shishim. Break it down and you only end up with 30,360. Ushem asar elef hechanim. Where are the 12,000? Ela elu sha'alu mishara shvatim. The answer is, and this is, Lori, what I meant a few weeks ago when I said we're going to get back to your original question. You had talked about the question of these people came from Bavel, which is one city within the empire. What about other people? And we also said those were just Binyamin and Yehuda. What about others potentially joining in? So this Medrash in Seder Olam says, you're right. The list you have here is just Yehuda and Binyamin. That's number one. And then number two, take a look at Malbim, who adds in those who came from elsewhere. V'chanir en, source number 6. V'chanir elo chashav bein ha-pratim es kol ha-ba'im Rakes Haba'im Rishonabim Bavel. He says it appears that it didn't list among all the individual families it broke out on the list everybody who came. Rather, it was just specifically those who came from Babylon, meaning that capital city. The Gam Nehemiah, and also when you see this list in chapter 7 of Nehemiah, shows if Gama Bayim Eretz Kazdim, there it's broader. It includes those who come from the land of the Chaldeans, which is a broader area. Still a Hashav HaKol, it didn't count everybody. Every day you had more people who didn't make it into the census. However, they were included in the overall number. When it got to saying how many were there, that counted everybody, including those whose names did not make it onto the list. Now, if I go back to my original reasons for having the name list, and if I take that explanation, our last explanation from the Gemara, that it's about the lineages, I understand why the other ones are not broken out on here. Because no one does any work on their lineage. These are people who just came in every day. There's no time to start investigating who's who. So therefore, they don't make it onto the enumerated list because we don't know what to say about them. Right? What are you going to say? These are people who joined in. Here are their names. I know nothing about who they are. Listing somebody and saying I know nothing about them is a death sentence. Right? That means they're going to be in this category of people who can't prove their lineage. They may be fine. We don't know. So therefore, they're omitted from the individual count, but they make it into the Mispara Kolel, this overall number. Follow? Well, not a problematic lineage. Of no one sat down and actually figured out their lineage.
Right, I know. No papers. Right.
Right. Unknown entirely, as opposed to I looked and couldn't find.
That's not a law.
Both. I mean, different Shvatim is what Seder Olam is saying, and Malbim is adding different cities. But yes, it's a large number. Yeah.
Dahlia. I just want to contemporize this kind of information.
Sure.
In today's Israel, we had all these people who came in after the Holocaust and said they were Jewish, and no one kind of like looked into how they were Jewish, and they just went about resettling into the country very nicely. And no one looked into whether or not they had been married and their spouse had been carefully designated as dead. And then many of them ended up remarrying. But there was no time and no efforts. And there was no possibility of looking into each and every refugee that came in. And then later, like in modern times, you know, like in the last couple of decades, when people come in, they're really over-processed now. And all of a sudden, it becomes a big deal when somebody comes in to find out their exact lineage. And it's just very interesting that so much of this is baloney, as far as I'm concerned, because it all depends on when you happen to arrive. So if you arrived on time with Nathaniel, you got looked into. And if you didn't, you weren't looked into and no one cared.
So I would say a couple of things. First, it's worth noting that there were those who were investigating,
yes,
even originally, meaning we have responsa upon responsa upon piles of responsa for Aguna situations that stemmed first from the Holocaust and then from the War of Independence as well. It's worth noting it isn't as though it was an ignored thing as much as the fact that it's true in terms of volume. You weren't able to address everything that...
No, it was like no one was trying to address anybody, but lots and lots of people felt the effect.
I believe that. But the other piece of it is that, I think the call of baloney is to shortchange a very significant and sophisticated halachic question. You know, the Gemara at the end of Kiddushin talks about Eliyahu HaNavi coming not to exclude anybody, but actually to cause people to be included. And that leads to a lot of question in the Gemara and halachic authorities about what exactly that means, but ultimately it culminates in a line in the Shulchan Aruch in the Code of Jewish Law, which says that if you know that there is a history of mamzerut, right, illegitimacy, in a family, but it's not publicly known, you're not supposed to go broadcasting it. It's not your job to go tell the world, by the way, you should know, you can't marry them because they're a mamzerim in the family. Whether you tell anybody at all is subject to a lot of debate. But this is, you know, to my mind, a very significant and challenging question in terms of how you practice Judaism in the wake of this kind of catastrophe. I think that I wouldn't write it off so, you know, so simply and say, well, it's under when you came.
It's kind of like really, I mean, we're seeing that this problem has existed in the
yes, correct.
There is a period in which so many refugees come in or so many people join the Jewish nation that there's no one keeping track of them.
Right.
And some of them have very good lineage and some of them have questionable lineage, and the same thing happened in the modern state of Israel.
Right. No, that parallel is very...
And I just feel sorry for some of the people coming in now when everybody has lots of time to investigate.
Right.
Because they drive them crazy.
Okay, yes.
Isn't that the argument you just made earlier in the sense that if you're choosing to join a prosperous environment, well, there's one reason for this. There are many reasons to do it. If you're choosing to go on an ordeal and a journey that promises to be less than pleasant, it by itself eliminates a lot of the
hanging on.
Profits. Yeah, hanging on.
But that's the thing. It's not what they did. In other words, what Dahlia is pointing out is that we have actually two different approaches within our list. We have the first 30-something thousand who are broken down based on which tribe they are from. You know, Kohen, Levi, Israel. Are they Kohenim who can prove who they are? Are they Kohenim who cannot prove who they are? Are they Israelim who can prove who they are? Are they Israelim who cannot prove who they are? We're going to see in the list in Nehemiah 7, you know, the Shtukia, Sufi, Mamzer, you know, list. We end up with 10 different types of lineage, as we charted last time. All stemming from Ezra's list of 30,000 or so. And then on the other end, there are the 12,000 who are just here. And don't know. We know nothing about them.
When I asked you if they could be people from other nations that were getting free at the same time, you said it's very unlikely because it was an arduous trip that they were going to take.
I mean, I would question whether anybody else wants to join in. I mean, that's true.
We've got all the slaves and stuff, so they're named slaves.
Right, we also have them. We break them down, too. This is true, but I'm going back to what I asked first. I'm not clear on the...
I'm saying that it was arduous for people to make this trip.
Yes.
And people who are not really part of the Jewish...
But that's the thing.
They do it for that reason.
Right, but if you were to make the claim that because it's arduous, we aren't so careful, because we just assume that means the person must be legit, then I'll ask, why is Ezra breaking down all the lineages? Or not just, I mean, Ezra, Book of Ezra. Leave aside Ezra's personal role within all of this. But why is the Book of Ezra talking to me about who is this kind and who is that kind and filtering all the different groups? Right? These are Shlomo's servants. These are Netinim who are servants, but they're not Shlomo's servants. You know, I think that argues that even if it's arduous, and even if it's a time when we don't have all the time in the world and we don't have all the resources, nonetheless, we're still going to care about who's whom. Yeah, you have two different things going on. You have two simultaneous events. You have one in which people are being documented and one in which people are just being told, okay, fine, you don't have a passport, don't worry about it. You know, they're going on side by side. Now, Encyclopedia Mikra Eats brings two other suggestions which would do away with all of this, but I think neither of them really works. One claim that they make, you could always say, and that's that maybe the original list was longer. In other words, maybe our original Sefer Ezra has the 30,000 that we have documented plus another 12,000 documented, and then that gives you the 42,000 which was part of the original text. I mean, you could say such a thing, I suppose, but really, I think that that's hard, because which part of the list did they disappear from? Did they disappear from the good ones? Did they disappear from the people who were the servants? There's nothing in this list that indicates a lacuna anywhere. That's one suggestion. The other suggestion that he suggests is maybe the ones we counted were just males. Maybe it's only the males who make it into the number, but the total number includes male and female. Abar Benel says actually the other way. He says the entire list is male, meaning the 42,000 is also male. He doesn't use this as a way to try to solve the problem, but the weakness in any case is... Yeah, the weakness is when we get to the female singers.
Right.
You know, for everybody else, you didn't care to mention the women, but now you got to the singers and you saw fit to mention that there are male and female singers. It seems a little bit odd if you're really just going by males. or heads of household or some such thing.
The fingers don't count. They have no yetas.
And yet you took the time to mention. Well, first of all, we numbered them.
Yeah.
We counted them. We said there are 200 of them.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and it's very interesting because in Reform and even at some concern, it was a very big issue that said it. Whether or not the people who sang in the choir had to be Jewish.
Right.
I'm serious.
No, that's an old issue.
And we tried everything else from these ancient sects, like you were telling us just now, that we try to decide whether or not it's correct to take a person from his own home today.
Right.
Put him under the protection of a sacred place. And we take that from the time of Farsi life, right?
Right.
So, therefore, we could also, you know, extemporize that. Do we, you know, how do we count our Jewish people in the same way? Is this brought here to teach us that there are times when we can be more lenient and times when we should be reductive?
Right. And the answer to that question is, I think we need to see, if we really want to look into it, I think when we get to Nehemiah chapter 7, we need to see it with that Gemara that talks about Eliyahu and what he's going to come to do, because I think that will give us a fuller picture of what we take away from, you know, from these lists. But I want to get to the singers, and especially because it seems very clear that the sages understood them to be Jewish. These were not non-Jewish singers, as we'll see in a moment. But is it Debbie who had a hand up?
12,000?
So they seem to be part of... I don't know.
If they're Jewish, then they should be part of the 12,000.
If they're Jewish, they should be...
If they're not Jewish, then we're saying that singers in the temple don't even... It doesn't really matter what they mean.
They're not singers in the temple. They're not singers in the temple. These are separate singers, as you'll see in a moment. But your question is a good question. I don't know whether we're meant to take them as part of the 42,000 or not. It's not at all indicated here. But there was a hand that... Is Debbie or Shana? Shana.
I was just going to point out that it also includes male and female servants.
Yes.
So maybe at this point, what this list is now dealing with is the logistics.
Right.
That's why we have the pack animals as well.
Right.
So you're talking about, you know, how they all got all out.
Right.
And for that, every body counts.
Right, and these are professionals. Yeah, they're listed with the professionals.
Yeah.
The other note just to make is to show you, go back to sentence 41, and we had the singers from among the Levium. So in other words, those were the temple singers. These are not temple singers. These are parade singers. You know, this is the band. This is the band, yeah.
Yeah.
I seem to remember learning way back that we do not decide halacha based on these kind of texts.
And the answer is
history.
Right. And the answer is maybe. We don't until we do, is the rough answer. Meaning that a side text which is clearly not written in a legal context will not be our primary source for something if we have primary sources. However, they can often be taken either to indicate what you would call mitziut, reality. Something like the Barzilai observation would be an example. There's no text there talking about, and the law therefore is you do whatever, but it's taken as an indication of what one would want. Similarly, you have the sort of another layer down from this in the Gemara, when they say that Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah refused to bow to the statue of Nebuchadnezzar, the statue Nebuchadnezzar had made, because they were threatened with death. But had they been threatened with torture, then they would have bowed. Which leads to all sorts of commentary, because what do you mean? Does that mean that pain is worse than death? And does that figure into halacha? Could you, in all sorts of different ways, depending on how we understand what Nebuchadnezzar's statue was. Was it an idol or was it not an idol? But the point is that passages like that and stories like that can become indicators of practical reality, which will affect the way we determine halacha. That's number one. But number two, verses in Navi will teach us halacha in the absence of biblical verses regularly. Meaning, when Yeshaya says, "Vikarata la Shabbat Oneg," you shall call Shabbat Oneg, that's where we get Oneg Shabbat, the idea of enjoying Shabbat with a mitzvah of having special meals, and so on. Also, from that same section in Yeshaya, teaches that you're not supposed to speak of weekday things on Shabbat, and you're not supposed to pursue your business on Shabbat. That's all Yeshaya. That's not found in Shmos or Vayikra. So we do use verses from Navi at times, And again, like I said, we don't until we do. That's what I would say simply. But let's take a look at what we're doing here, because I want to get to the singers. These four singers. You had a question in the back.
No,
Joseph. Yeah.
I just thought that somebody said something about the numbers being included. They're not included. The Pasuk says specifically of Rosh Bilvad, excluding. They're not included in the 42.
Milavad Avdeim. Yeah, you're right. They're excluded. Thank you. So this business of the singers is an interesting one. Like, I'm almost tempted to say that the job of the singers is to chant, to help people as they're, you know, walking along with the animals, to sort of just like, you know, but they're not rowing. You know, if you're rowing, you need a chant. Like, I don't know what you're doing if you're, you know, just, you know, riding animals.
In the army, they used to make us chant.
Right, it's a military thing. The keeping time. Well, take a look at what I brought you on your sheet. Rashi in source number 7 gives you a different take, as does Ibn Ezra. Lefi shahayu olim b'simcha mibavel le'eretz Yisrael. They were ascending with joy from Babylon to Israel. Hayu tzrichim l'mesharim u'mesharot. They needed these singers. Kedeshu metailim b'hem b'rov simchatam. So that, metailot b'hem b'rov simchatam, so that they would travel with joy. They would enjoy themselves along the way. They'd be happy in their travels. Ibn Ezra says in number 8, V'lahem misharim u'misharo lahalei Hashem, they have male and female singers to sing to God. So this was a means of praising Hashem. Now someone is going to ask me at some point, do you then see that this is, that there's no concern for Kol Isha? Right? There's none of the halachic concern for women singing, because after all, you had male and female singers with the group. To which I'll respond, who says the men and women ascended together? You know, maybe the male group that was ascending and the female group that was ascending, and the males had male singers and the females had the female singers. The various people who have asked this question, Rav Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld dealt with this in his work Shamat Chaim, Rav Chaim David Alevi and Asei L'Charav, and they gave different answers. Either their answer was that you're talking about the view that there's a basic debate as to how to understand the prohibition against a man listening to a woman sing. In and of itself, is it a biblical prohibition or is it a rabbinic prohibition? If you take the view that it's a rabbinic prohibition, then they are well before the rabbinic decree, and therefore this wasn't even a concept. There's nothing to discuss. Alternatively, though, you take the view that they did it in a permitted way. Everybody will, well, not everybody. Any sentence on a halakhic matter like this one that starts with the word everybody is wrong right then, you should just stop there. But there are permitted ways to have women singing, and the answer is they did it in whatever permitted way, you know, whatever way that you know that your halakhic authority deems is permitted. That's what you should imagine when you read this. Whether that means that it was women singing as a group, or the men couldn't see the women, or the men were here and the women were there, or whatever you want to work.
Wandering among them,
among whom?
What,
yeah.
What do you mean?
The translation.
What does it say?
Singers, so that they would wander among them in their great
joy. Oh, you're talking about my translation. Right. So I wasn't sure what to do with metailot bahem, whether that's a description of the singers, and the singers are wandering among them, or whether it meant the people who are walking will go up with great joy. The problem I have is that the word letayel doesn't fit the ascending from Babel to Israel. Meaning, you would not describe this as a tiul.
That's exactly what Masuz Kavis says. Uses the word tiul.
Bismcha u'tiul. Matsuna David says, Bismcha u'tiul.
Yeah.
Interesting. So then he's drawing on this Rashi, and the answer will have to be that it's talking about the people, not the singers. That the people who are journeying should have a nice trip. Okay.
Well, I think it's like, to you, it's also kind of like an adventure.
Yeah.
You don't want to be.
Yeah. This definitely was an adventure. I don't know. I'm going to change wander to travel and be done with it.
Female title also has a version of the
show. Female singers. Miriam and
the. So they're all. No, they're very clearly separate. It says specifically that Miriam went out with the women. Uh-huh. There's no, you know, they're very clearly separate. Yeah. So, all right, so they all go up to, they all travel, hello, with these in these various numbers, and then you get to Pasuk Samachet, sentence 68, page 1819. Umarashei ha'avos, and from the heads of the families, bevo'am lebeis Hashem asher b'Yerushalayim, when they came to the house of God in Jerusalem, the future house of God, because it wasn't the house of God yet, but to the site anyway, is Nadvu Lebesa Elokim, they donated to the house of God, Lahamido al Mechono, to establish it on its foundation. Kichocham Nasnu Laotsar Hamalacha Zahav Darkimonim Sheshribo Osva Elef. So according to their ability, they gave to the storehouse for the work, they gave gold, and the gold is 61,000 darkimonim, darkimon being some kind of a coin. V'chesef manim chameshes alafim, as well as 5,000 maneh silver. V'chasnos kohanim me'ah, and 100 garments for the kohanim. V'yeshivu ha-kohanim v'aleviyim u'min ha'am v'amasharim v'asharim v'anesinim be'areihem. And all of them, the kohanim, the leviyim, the nation, the singers, the gatekeepers, the nesinim, they all went to their cities. V'chol Yisrael be'areihem. And all Israel, which that Mikra assumes refers to the people from the other tribes who had joined in, they all go to their cities. Does that make sense? That's one problem. What else is wrong here in this picture? Right, well, that would be a practical issue that they'd have to be concerned with, but there's something else that's wrong. What were they supposed to do?
Build the temple.
Why are you all running to Shem and Hebron and wherever else? What happened to the actual enterprise you were sent here to do? They all go to their city, so that's going to be an issue when we get to chapter 3, this question. But take a look at Malvin in source number 9, who explains what the issue was. Shebivoam hisasku tchila la'avodas ha'adama. Initially, they had to work the land, la'achin lechem, in order to get bread. Vayizru'u sados, they planted their fields. Vayidu kramim, they planted vineyards. Vayasu pri tivua, they made produce. Laval yisu chepat ra'av, lest they suffer from famine. Vigam, and also, sha'achar shalana salam reshus livnos ha'choma, since they didn't have permission to build a wall, lo his yashvu b'Yerushalayim, they didn't settle in Jerusalem, that would have been dangerous. Rak shotetu b'areihem, they instead wandered to their cities, v'chol achad is yashev b'ir acheres, each one in another city, sheyashvu shem avosav b'zman kadum, where his ancestors had lived before the exile. So he's giving me two reasons why they're not building a temple and settling in Jerusalem. Number one, you need to support your family. And number two, you have no protection in Jerusalem. You're just a sitting duck. And yes, it's true, as was noted here, they're sitting ducks in their random cities as well. But maybe if you're in smaller numbers, you're less of a target. Maybe that would be why. The Kohanim and Leviim, they went to the 48 Levite cities. The Yisrael is Yashvu b'Arei Yisrael. And Yisrael went, the Yisraelim went to their cities. Okay, so that, by the way, the last clause in the Malbim is just to explain the language in sentence 70, where it mentioned the Kohanim and the Leviim, and then it came to call Yisrael at the end, right? So he's saying the first part was the cities of the Kohanim, Leviim, and these other people who were mentioned, the singers, the servants. However, the call Yisrael Barahem is talking about Yisraelim.
Aren't these singers the gatekeepers?
Oh, the Mishorim, right, these are not the singers, right, these are Levi singers, right, that works even better. That helps me further.
Too.
Yeah, gatekeepers are clearly Levi. Yeah. Okay. So that's going to bring us to the third chapter and the new land, and restarting the Beis HaMikdash and carrying out the mission. So we're not going to get very far here, just because, as far as I can tell, if I started it, then, yeah, no, we've got like 4 minutes. So what I want to do is just show you the first couple of sentences, at least. I want to cheat you the 4 minutes. and raise certain questions. Chapter 3, sentence 1. Vayiga hachodesh hashvi'i ubnei Yisrael be'arim. The seventh month arrived. Not the seventh month since their arrival, but the seventh month. What is the seventh month on our calendar? Tishrei, right? Seventh month is Tishrei. So the seventh month arrived. Ubnei Yisrael be'arim, and the Jews are in their cities. Vayasfu ha'am ki ish echad el Yerushalayim. And they all gathered as one to Jerusalem. So already I have certain questions. Like, why did it take until Tishrei? We don't know what month the original journey went on in. But why did it take until Tishrei for them to gather? And what is the significance of Tishrei? And we know what Tishrei is for us, right? Tishrei for us is Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, right? Good time to be in Yerushalayim.
The harvest is planted.
The harvest. Oh, the harvest is in at this point. You've gathered everything. Rosh Hashanah is not a required pilgrimage, that's true. But I think that we're thinking about it too much in terms of our own terms. What would Tishrei have meant for them? There's another element which is going to be very important, which you have to think about from their perspective in order to understand what's going on.
The rainy season?
No. We'll see. But look what happens in Pasuk Bet. Vayakam Yeshua ben Yotzadak. Yeshua ben Yotzadak. This is one of those cases where the hays slip in and out. Meaning sometimes he is Yeshua ben Yotzadak, sometimes he's Yeshua ben Yehotzadak. But he is, in fact, the Kohen Gadol. Although he's not given that title at this stage, we find out later he's the Kohen Gadol. Ve'achav HaKohanim, as well as his brother Kohanim. Uzrubavel ben Sha'altiel. There he is, Zrubavel. Ve'achav and his brothers. Vayivnu es mizbach Elokei Yisrael. They built the altar of Hashem, God of Israel. La'alos alav olos, to bring upon it burnt offerings. Kakasuv b'saras Moshe isho Elokim, as recorded in the Torah. In the Torah of Moshe. Tell me, why do you need that last clause? As recorded in the Torah of Moshe. As opposed to what? What other model were you working with?
The Great Mishkan.
You mean that? Oh, in other words, they're going back to the Mishkan model. You think they're working with the Mishkan? Could be. Elisheva.
Because didn't they just bring korbans to their other gods? So this is the korban you're allowed to bring, as it's written in the Torah. Like those.
In other words, I might have thought, if you didn't say this, that they were actually building, yeah, that they were actually bringing, you know, Avodah Zarah, they were performing idolatry.
I didn't think so.
Okay. We'll have to see. I think there's something going on here. I don't think that this, I think this is part of a bigger picture. But the most perplexing one is Pasuk Gimel, sentence 3, and that's what we'll conclude with. Ve'achinu ha-mizbeach al-machonosav. They established the altar on its foundations. Ki be'ema aleihem me'ameh ha'aratos, because they were afraid of the nations of the lands. They're afraid of their neighbors. Vayalu alav olos l'Hashem, and they brought offerings on it to God. Olos labokir v'lo arev, offerings morning and evening. Where's the cause and effect in this sentence? They were afraid of their neighbors, therefore they built the altar. If you would have asked me, if you're afraid of the neighbors, you don't build the altar. Right?
No, but maybe their neighbors would take over this place now that they sort of come back and start building altars to foreign gods. So they rushed in and made sure that this wasn't going to happen.
So they're afraid that the neighbors are going to build altars for their gods, and therefore they choose to build an altar to Hashem.
Right, right. To make sure this doesn't happen.
Right.
On the other hand, yeah. Perhaps they're doing this in order to give God's favor. They're looking for God.
Right. Perhaps it's a search for divine protection. Could be. So we're going to have to talk about all of this, God willing, next week. Thank you very much.
Thank you.